newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on what's going on in the news media these days, with some insights into ethical decision-making in newsrooms by some veteran journalists. I'm Rex Smith from the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union, and we are here with some colleagues in Studio D here at 318 Central Avenue in Albany. Next to me here is Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. How are you doing?
Happy to be here. And as a new teacher,
yes,
not a new teacher, but a teacher of a semester about to start, mm-hmm. I'm a little nervous about being in a D. Getting it
Studio
right
D.
Away.
Yeah.
Studio
well,
all these
a.
years, the best we could do is Studio D. Why aren't we not even Studio B?
B-plus.
I never knew this was Studio
C-plus.
D.
So what's on your mind today, Barbara?
I'm hoping that we'll talk about the Washington crime situation, what the president is telling the country, and what the facts say.
Good, good. Sounds like a great topic. The voice you already heard there is Ira Fesfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York, and affiliated publications. Ira, glad you're back.
Nice to see you. Well, you know, I would have to turn in my retired publisher's card if I didn't find a good story about publishing and making money and increasing your value. And that's what's going on with the New York Times. Despite Trump's constant barrage of how it's fake news, the New York Times has never been doing better. And perhaps we can talk about how that influences both them, but the industry at large.
What's going on there that they are able to succeed when so many others are failing? And joining us for Media Project today is Times Union columnist Chris Churchill. How about that? Chris Churchill is here. What's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I'm thinking about presidential truth-telling.
Seems to be the topic of the day. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. Topic of the month, of the year, of the decade.
You know, I think you're right, just to set that up. You know, the move to federalize law enforcement in Washington to put hundreds of troops into the street came because Trump said the nation's capital city is unsafe and disgusting. And he said, it's become a situation of complete and total lawlessness. And he said, it's getting worse. But that's not true. You know, the fact is, Department of Justice reports that violent crime in D.C. is down 35% since 2023 to the lowest rate in 30 years. Assaults with a dangerous weapon are down 27%. Homicides down 32%. Armed carjacking down 53%. So what are journalists supposed to do about that?
I want to say, first of all, that what you proclaim to be facts might be your interpretation of facts, Rex.
Oh, I see.
Because you're using actual documented numbers provided by law enforcement.
As opposed to
the White House, which says in big letters in their press release, fact, yes, D.C. crime is out of control. And they proceed to make proclamations that are not only not true, but are just outright lies, even though crime might be an issue in D.C. and in other big cities. What they are claiming is not true. And extra disconcerting is the press release from the White House tries to denigrate the news. Don't believe anything else except what we're telling you. To quote them, unfortunately, while fake news journalists and politicians go out of their way to claim otherwise, the reality is that our nation's capital is anything but safe. So they are going above and beyond what they ought to be doing as an administration.
I remember I was watching Meet the Press when Kellyanne Conway actually said that phrase the first time.
Alternative facts.
Alternative facts, yes. And that was chilling.
Seems to be, unfortunately, actually Chuck Todd called her on it right away, but it's a big deal. So what do we do about that? Chris, what's your thought?
Well, I mean, I think you report the facts. I think you report the data as it exists. But I do worry a little bit that journalists are maybe going too far in making it sound as though everything is fine and dandy in Washington. I mean, 200 murders, still 200 murders. That isn't a number that we should become numb to or accept, right? And I do think there have been a lot of people who keep saying, well, Washington's perfectly safe. Washington's a typical American city, which, you know, it may be a typical American city, but it does have neighborhoods and places in the perceptions of high crime, right? And whether or not what Trump is doing is the right way to address any of that is a different question. But I do think you shouldn't just try to wipe the problem away and say that everything's fine and dandy.
So you worry that journalists in trying to...
Some of the news coverage seemed to be emphasizing the fact that crime is down, right? But it almost went too far, to me at least, in making it sound as though there was no actual problem.
I don't think they made it sound like there's no problem, but the media reports, I think, went too far in trying to nitpick about those statistical numbers when the focus has to continue to be on, is there an emergency in D.C. that would justify the feds coming in to take over?
So you're sitting around the newsroom and you get a press release on Friday and it says this is what the inflation number is or this is what the employment number is. How are we supposed to deal with those numbers? Are we now skeptical of those numbers because Trump has thrown a bug in our ear about how the numbers were rigged by the Bureau of Labor Statistics? What do we do with these numbers?
I think the difficulty is that there is nothing that you can trust anymore. You know,
including us, many would say.
Well, I think that's the problem. In his effort to make sure that journalists can't be trusted, he's now installed at the head of the FDA, at the head of the FBI, the CDC, the CIA. Actually, all of these people are not committed, I don't think, to fact. And so we are suspicious of everything, and that undermines actually, I'd say, democracy, because I think we sort of need to have some sort of a shared sense of what's true, of where at least you find truth, to be able to go forward to have a functioning and healthy democratic system. So, Chris, I mean, to your point, it may be that journalists ought not to overstate the misstatement, but isn't a bigger problem the loss of trust, the intentional distortion of reality by the federal government?
That is a problem. As a working journalist, it sometimes feels like everything is sand. There's nothing that's firm. The flip side of that, though, is that I think journalists should always be skeptical of information coming from the government, no matter who the president is. We've all seen stories, including out of Washington, where, you know, police departments have fudged numbers, and it's always our job to double check those numbers or to make sure that they seem real.
I think that's right. A healthy skepticism is a fundamental of journalism, mm-hmm. right?
And it also becomes difficult when you can't get the right numbers or you're trying to do research. There was another instance where the administration had made claims about convictions in other countries about crime. And when the news outlet that was trying to report on that tried to request the data, they were getting stalled and stalled and stalled. And then we're finally just told, never mind, we're not providing anything.
But that said, you know, when journalists do look into numbers, if you do develop a relationship with any administration, whether it's a local administration or a national one, and if they have a reputation for being credible, you're more likely to believe what they say, right? And I think a lot of administrations care about their credibility. I'm not sure this one does quite as much.
It doesn't need to, right? Because its base believes, I mean, Trump has, as they say, a high floor and a low ceiling. He always has about 42% support no matter what he does so far over the last decade. That has been his base of support. And the question is, has he ever gotten over 50% support? I don't believe he has, maybe shortly after he's inaugurated. But the fact is he doesn't care really so much about credibility because his people are with him no matter what, and he's enforcing that. So the difficulty for us is how far we go in a system where, I like your analogy, Chris, that everything feels like sand mm-hmm. beneath us.
I think it's important that the media keep repeating, even if they feel like it's repetition, the truth about things or pointing out. For instance, I happened to catch Jake Tapper when they were first talking about the president's talking about being tough on crime. And then he throws in the line about, the worst thing in Washington, the toughest situation involving crime in Washington was probably January 6th, and he has absolved of any wrongdoing all of the people who were convicted of beating police and conducting other violent behavior. Okay, so is that editorializing? I think not, because it's putting things into context. You have him saying this, and here's what he's actually done on that. And so I think that's important. MSNBC had, when they were reporting on it, they had a split screen with Trump speaking and then the numbers. Although, getting back to what Chris would say, I agreed, like, you can't bury yourself in the numbers. People are going to glaze over, and it's the issue that's more important.
Well, and numbers don't always correspond with how people feel. I mean, right. This is something that we see all the time when it comes to crime, especially. And that's why the reporting should report the numbers, but also include reports from the neighborhoods, right? Do people feel less safe? Is crime that was once confined to a small area expanding into
the
areas
anecdote.
where it wasn't before? Yeah.
I don't know if they showed this, but I just didn't see it. Was they could have been videoing neighborhoods to show people just walking around and people are not cowering behind their chained windows.
You know, one of the advantages of a columnist role, Chris, which you have, is that you can give texture, I think, more easily than a straight news report can. You can kind of draw on that feeling to express what people are really feeling. And we kind of look to columnists for that. That has been traditionally the case. But I wonder the extent to which straight news reporting has become so much more textured in recent years that we've been forced to, for one reason or another, brought that kind of a voice into news reporting as well.
Are you saying that there's a lot of opinion in news reporting? Because I think that there is.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I read stories in the New York Times or other papers all the time that are straight news stories that seem to have a lot of opinion slipping in.
Well, let's just slip into that for a second, because Ira wanted to talk about the success of the New York Times. Do you think, Ira, that that's one of the reasons why the Times has been so successful, why they're, what, approaching 12 million digital subscribers?
Yeah, that, for the uninitiated, the New York Times stock hit an all-time high last week. The company enjoyed a strong second quarter, growing in all of its major revenue streams. And that was the key part of the equation for me, all of its major revenue streams. It's no longer just New York Times print edition. It's no longer just New York Times print and digital edition, but it's New York Times with all of these affiliated digital sites that are drawing people into their site. And we're now seeing literally millions of people, many more people than ever before, reading New York Times products. I was just going to go back for a half a second and mention, I think Chris is right. There is more opinion in the news stories now, and I think it's just something that has evolved. We've talked about it here for years, both sidesism, and now there's more likely to be, if there's a story about the Bureau of Labor Statistics that says we have this number of whatever, there now needs to be a piece of the story that says, except, you know, the last time this organization put out numbers, the president claimed they were rigged. It's changed the entire way of us presenting the numbers and reporting the numbers.
But I would challenge Chris and Ira on that contention that it's more opinion in the stories, where I'm going to say that it's context, which is the reporter's responsibility to get beyond that he said, she said, which was overly common, and now be more diligent about telling
the full
story.
And of course, we never had a president like Trump. But we never used to have somebody say, Trump said this, and then the next paragraph says, but Trump has a history of lying.
But it's not just that he has a history of lying. It would be Trump says this, but in reality, here's the fact of what actually has happened or is happening.
So is that an opinion or?
It is not an opinion. It's a fact.
Isn't that necessary now? I mean, I'm about to the point of saying that traditional journalism is dead and ought to be. That the kind of stuff that we all ascribe to as journalists of saying you have to give people a fair story right down the middle has lost its currency in the era of Trump. Because as Glenn Kessler, the Washington Post fact checker who just left his job, retired after some 30 years, Glenn Kessler says Trump has made it acceptable for politicians to lie with impunity. And so many people are doing it now intentionally. Lying. And isn't that so that journalists have to call it out then?
Journalists do have to call out lies, but I think they have to be careful about the way they do it. I think calling something a lie, I think that's an opinion, right? Because you don't
only,
know.
Only if it's a lie.
What?
You lost me there a little bit.
I'm sorry, it's getting a little meta. Let me start saying that again.
Yeah.
if it's a lie, it's not an opinion to call it a lie.
But we never call
it. But you don't know if it's a lie because you don't know if the person actually believes it.
That's right.
Oh, boy.
Semantic?
Oh, my God.
Isn't that semantic?
No, if I really think the sky is green and I say the sky is green, I'm wrong. You can say that I'm wrong, but to call me a liar, unless you know that I.
Oh, so we could say Trump is not necessarily a liar. He's just demented.
Or colorblind.
No, I mean, again, maybe it is semantics, but I think that's an element where you see it in news stories now where you wouldn't have seen it 10 or 15 years ago. And even you see words that I was always taught don't use, like surprising. In a surprising announcement, Well, it might have been surprising to me, but like, maybe it's not surprising to somebody else, and maybe just say what the announcement is and let the reader decide.
Get rid of a lot of those adjectives.
Yeah, but the New York Times and other newspapers are full of them now.
I think that's lame editing and writing to have those kind of adjectives in there. You know, it was Kessler who had the experience where he went to the State Department to ask about Trump's, the administration claimed that Europe's Digital Services Act, that thousands of people have been convicted for criticizing the government, different countries. So it was stated as a fact. And then he's trying to ask the State Department to corroborate that with some facts, provide some backup for that. And that's what, where they did not provide any evidence. They said they needed more time. And then finally, they just declined to comment. So you don't have to say that they lied. But you could say Trump or the administration or whoever it is claimed such and such, but provided no documentation to corroborate.
Right. That's a fair way to do it.
So yeah. Why do you think, to go back to my point about the New York Times, why do you think it's doing as well as it is? And should the line of other companies that are going to be doing the same, or are they already lining up? Or is New York Times unique?
Well, I think there are two things there. First, there is something unique about the quality of their work. They're the largest newsroom. They really have capacity because of all this money that you cited they're raking in, hundreds of millions of dollars a quarter. They can afford to hire a lot of people and have 1,300 people in the newsroom. But second, they do have all these other verticals. They have food and The Athletic for sports, and they have games, of course. You know?
Right. Wordle is nonpartisan.
And that's, there's something old school about that, too, isn't there? Because, you know, 50 years ago, a good chunk of the people who were buying the newspaper that on whatever day were buying it for the classifieds or the comics or
crossword puzzle.
Crossword puzzle.
The bridge things they, column.
Things they could get nowhere else. And then newspapers slowly lost all that. And now the New York Times has found a way to kind of bundle again, right? But it does take resources to develop your own game like Wordle. I don't know how you do that exactly.
Very smart.
You're a small newspaper.
Yeah, I counted actually the Washington Post podcast that is their daily podcast. And the credits that they listed had 21 staff working to put out a single half-hour podcast, which is pretty amazing. And that's not as big a newsroom, of course, as the New York Times. But these rich newsrooms have amazing capacity to build audience.
Well, they also just go out and buy things if they want it, right? Like, they bought The Athletic, so they have a depth of sports reporting.
Well, they replaced their own sports coverage. They gave that up.
And, right, but they also acquired, you know, hundreds of sports journalists working all across the globe. So not many news organizations can do that.
So to Ira's question, is it because of the voice of the Times, do you think,
I think they've made a number of smart business decisions with acquisitions such as the one that Chris just mentioned. But I think that beyond that, they have something that's unique, and the depth and the volume of their coverage is something that we and other publications, big and small, could admire but can't replicate. And they've moved smartly and quickly, and they did it not just in the face of what's going on in the newspaper industry, but in the face of all of the competitors out there. If Rex Smith wants to write a column today for Substack, he can go and write a column for Substack, as could hundreds of other journalists. And who knows how many other Substack-like companies out there. Podcasts, videos, there's just so much time and there's so much content. And it's amazing to me that the New York Times, is even with all of its resources, is able to develop as many readers as they have, because there's so much more competition than there used to be.
Well, let me ask you about that in this context. Nearly 10,000 journalists have been laid off from newsrooms over the past 3 years. Meanwhile, a lot of young journalists who are leaving school, getting a job, are being urged to build your brand. Now, I guess that's a testament to the fact that, listen to the way that people get their news these days. More people are accessing news through social media and video networks than anywhere else. 54% of Americans get their news through social media and video networks. TV news is less than that. It's 50%. News websites and apps, which would include traditional text media like newspapers, 48%. So that, I guess, is why people are being told, build your brand. But then doesn't that mean that everybody is going out to try to be Chris Churchill? I mean, you have a personal brand. People turn to your voice to say, I want to know what Churchill thinks about this thing. And it does seem, as Ira is saying, with all the with Substack and Patreon and Beehive and all the other platforms out there, with YouTube and so on, brand is important. But what that raises a question about is whether then straightforward news reporting still has currency, right?
I think you can build a brand through straightforward news reporting, though. And I think there's actually, if there's an untapped market demand out there, I think that might be where it is. Especially in the TV world, it's, you know, most of the networks are, most of the content they put out is opinion content. I do think there's a place. What worries me about going out and building your brand is for some people take that to mean become famous and do whatever it takes to become famous as quickly as possible, which is easier to do now than it would have been when I was first getting into journalism, because you can go on social media and say all sorts of outrageous things, and you'll, if you say enough outrageous things, you'll get well known pretty quickly. But
you wouldn't want to be branded.
What kind of brand is that? Yeah, it's brand and the word reputation are similar.
And but you can now build a brand and become famous and rich, I dare say, as a freelance person. I don't mean freelance in the way that we know it is in our industry, but there are so many other locations where you can stick a flag in the ground and start producing content. And if it's good content and interesting content, it'll draw an audience and it'll help develop your brand.
Mm-hmm.
You, Chris Churchill, your brand was established by the good work that you do, but you do it within the framework of a traditional newspaper, which is making your content available to the public. Now you don't have to be. I mean, if you left the Times Union tomorrow and decided to put out a column and find a place to put it, you could do that, and you could build as successful, if not more so, than you currently have it now. We didn't used to have those options.
Don't give him ideas. You know, you're going to make his boss unhappy.
But it's all about reputation, and it's that you earn.
Well, that's another word for brand, no?
Yeah, I mean, some of this just sounds like new lingo for the same old putting yourself out there in a way that people know that they can trust you and they're familiar with you. Just, it would be... in the old days, it would be looking for a byline of somebody that you trust. It could just be print, or if it was TV, you know, the face and the byline. But isn't that basically just fancy now terms for being trustworthy and having a reputation that people know to look for? They want to see what you have to say.
I wish.
I think some of what you're describing has actually become more difficult to do because there are so many people trying to do it. I think 20 years ago, they're just called bloggers.
Right.
There are people just throwing their own stuff onto their own websites. And there are people who got very well known. And one Pulitzer is doing that. Glenn Greenwald would be one, or an Andrew Sullivan. I think it's a lot harder to do now because there's just so many more people attempting to do it.
Isn't the end for an awful lot of people simply attention? Don't we live, in fact, in the attention economy? You can monetize attention even if you're not credible. I think the apogee of this is the Kardashians. What are they famous for? Except being famous.
Yeah.
And that, I think, shows the danger for journalism, where if what we produce, it just draws attention. The difficulty is that facts and serious journalism are not as attractive necessarily as attention, as fun. It's the old asparagus and ice cream debate. What we really like is sometimes not what we need.
Well, also, a lot of this band, when people are building their brand, there often is not a whole lot of reporting that goes into it. I mean, if you're going out and reporting a story, and in many ways you're putting your own ego behind the voices of the people that you are talking to. And I don't see a lot of that in a lot of the journalism, especially the online kind of outrage stoking tweets and things that people use to build their brands.
Yeah, I would agree with you about the challenge of trying to get your name out there. If you don't have legacy media behind you to lend credibility and give you a set outlet to a predictable audience, then it is hard to get your name out there.
I mean, I do understand the impulse. There was a time where if you got a job at a good newspaper, say the Boston Globe, you could know that if you did good work for decades, you would still be working at the Boston Globe, and slowly you could build your brand till you might become a columnist or somebody that was well known, right? Or Walter Cronkite, right? He didn't start as Walter Cronkite. Now you don't have the assurance that that organization's going to exist or that your job is safe. So you feel like you got to do it quickly. And that's fundamentally different, I guess, than doing it slowly and doing it the right way and doing it with hard work.
The evolving news industry is certainly a topic that we deal with all the time here, and we've run out to the end of our half hour talking about it here. Folks, if you have a thought you'd like to bring up, media@wamc.org is how you interact with us here at the Media Project. Ira Fussfeld's been here, Chris Churchill, Barbara Lombardo, and I'm Rex Smith. With thanks to our producer, DeGustina, and thank you for joining us. Hope you come back again next week for the Media Project.
It's wonderful to represent the globe. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such an interesting...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, Adjunct Professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
For romance, but finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the globe. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.